Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. This episode of Into the Wild is brought to you by Leica Sport Optics. Born in Germany, Leica products are the creation of over 100 years of knowledge in developing and manufacturing optical systems. Leica's quest? Simple. Creating awareness and bringing people closer to the wonders of nature. In an era of increasingly threatened wilderness, Leica serves those who treasure it by promising and delivering the ability to see wildlife as you've never seen it before. First conceived in 1958, today's iconic Trinovid HD binoculars are designed for the widest array of uses. They expertly combine high-definition optical performance, outstanding mechanical features, and easy, intuitive operation in a durable form. I'm new to the world of binoculars, and after just one use of the Trinovids, even I could tell the power behind this bit of equipment. And now, on with the show. Welcome back and a happy new year to you! I mean, seriously, I hope it's happy. Jesus, we need happy, right? Welcome to the 2021 series of Into the Wild, and damn do we have not only exciting episodes to bring you this year, but a new section of Into the Wild that we drop in the very near future. I know, pretty bloomin' exciting, right? However, right now, we are here for today's episode, and this week, I spoke with carnivore biologist Gabby Fleuret. Gabby and I spoke about the heavy and difficult topic of poaching. Woo! 2021, let's talk about death! Seriously though, I decided to put this episode first because it's what I believe this new year is in need of. Discussion and listening. Even when it's topics that make us uncomfortable, that's certainly what Into the Wild believes in. So that's what Gabby and I did. They told me about their career working in the field trying to solve predator and community conflict, and reasons why poaching even exists in the first place. I also asked Gabby what their thoughts or feelings are when they read or hear of people suggesting poachers should be killed. Gabby says it clearly, don't devalue human life. Accept that humans are a part of a holistic ecosystem, and the best way to help wildlife? If Gabby could change just one thing, end poverty. Disclaimer, we talk about poaching. Instruction, listen with an open mind. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hello, Gabby. Welcome to Into the Wild. Now, this is a weird one because it's still December, so I will at one point be wishing you a Merry Christmas, but this will be released in January. So at this point, I'll say Happy New Year. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. We kind of met on Twitter in the nature world, the wildlife world, and over a topic that's quite heavy that we'll be talking about today, but I'm determined, and I'm sure you share this with me, to keep it as light and upbeat as possible.
We'll try.
Let's give it a go. Before we jump into that, let's start a bit about yourself. For the listeners and for me, do you want to start by telling us who you are and what is it you do?
Sure. So my name is Gabby Fleuret. I'm a conservation biologist. I specialize mostly in human-wildlife conflict mitigation, particularly predator and livestock mitigation. And real quick, it's basically like trying to be a diplomat between farmers and predators. It's trying to stop predators from eating farmers' livestock and stop farmers from killing predators, and trying to work within communities to create kind of community-based and driven solutions to a really complicated problem. So it's pretty exciting. I usually work on my main study areas in Southern Africa. But I've also have a little bit of experience in Eastern Africa as well. And I'm looking forward to doing a Fulbright in Botswana, testing out some different deterrents with African wild dogs in collaboration with Botswana Predator Conservation, an NGO there, as well as Cheetah Conservation Botswana. And I'm applying for PhDs to do the same work. And recently I've been named Forbes, one of Forbes 30 Under 30 in Science, which is really exciting. And just getting started. I consider myself kind of a conservation biologist technologist. So I'm a conservationist who looks at things in a very engineering type way. But yeah, that's what I do.
That's amazing. Like you said, you're only just starting your career. What a list to start with. And that's something you were saying there about the conflict side of things. It's something I think a lot of people, we spoke about it ever so slightly on our trophy hunting episode last year, but
it's something that I think a lot of people don't think about conflict wise, you know, especially when you imagine myself here in London, especially, right? We don't think about conflict. I mean, the most we have is a aggressive squirrel on the bird feeder. That's about it. But fair. I mean, what kind of issues are we looking at? Like, I mean, globally, when people have conflict with wildlife?
So I would say that, you know, human wildlife conflict is, for at least for predator species, so carnivores, which is what I mostly focus on, is after habitat destruction is the biggest threat to carnivore survival. It's massive, but I think it's very flies under the radar, in terms of like academia, but also in terms of just like general public knowledge. And some of the conflicts we're talking about are, for example, like crop destruction in elephants and great apes, you know, communities living near parks or in wildlife areas. And then you get, you know, like, for example, someone's entire maize crop can be wiped out in one night, and then they can't afford to feed their families or send their kids to school. And it creates a lot of, you know, anger in the local community, as can be understood about, you know, and I think this is something that kind of doesn't really work in translation, because people, you know, from the States or from Europe, like, you know, we love animals and we love, like, elephants are cool, but, you know, you would feel very differently if they were, you know, destroying your livelihood. And the same thing with predators is that it's very easy. I always say it's very easy from like New York City to be like, yeah, I love lions. Like, how could someone ever kill a lion? They're so majestic. Haven't you seen Mufasa? Like, this whole thing. And I'm like, well, if it ate your livestock and that was how you fed your family or sent your children to school or provided for your business. And there's also a cultural component of the amount of livestock that you have being directly related to your stay in the community and all these other things that we, you know, as foreigners can't fully understand. Yeah, there's a lot of frustration, and there's a lot of like, I'm probably going on too much, but like there's a lot of things of like political ecology as well, where people feel disenfranchised from the government because the government is giving preference to wildlife over their own people, because of tourism. So a lot of frustration as well in many different places. So super complicated, really fascinating, because you're dealing with both behavioral ecology from the predator side of like, how can I get into the head of a jackal and figure out how it thinks and try to disrupt its, you know, its patterns, but also from the human side of how do I work with people's, you know, cultural beliefs, their governmental beliefs, their economic concerns, and really try to speak to them and work with them to try to find solutions.
Do you often find that it's working with the communities and the local people is at the forefront of what you do?
That's all I do. Yeah. It has, because the solutions have to come from the community. It's not even just buy-in. It's like you have to be able to work with the community at the beginning of your work to come up with a solution together, or there's no sustainability. And I'm a big proponent of, as someone from the diaspora, I'm a big proponent of someone like, I don't like the idea of like neocolonialism, right? Like in be just coming in and saying like, look, I've never seen a lion in my life, but here, let me tell you how to deal with your lions. And I think it's really important to not just kind of passively have workshops and do it because you know you're supposed to do it as a good scientist, but really entrench your work in the community. And it's so important to not only just do science, but also to try to have something beneficial to the community. If you're going to involve them in the research, they should also get something out of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's strange to think that when we put it in words like that, it's hard to think that people don't work in that way. Yeah. Like, it sounds so obvious, doesn't it? When we word it like that, it's going, why is it not happening like that?
Yeah, it's harder. It's a lot harder, I think, than just kind of doing
that. That's it.
Yeah,
that is absolutely it. Back to yourself a little bit. Like, this is a question we ask all our guests. How did your love for wildlife and nature begin for you?
I always say that, like, that's always a really tough question, and I'm doing essays right now for grad school, and like they want to hear like a narrative of like the moment. I've always been obsessed with wildlife since I was 3 years old. My dad is of Angolan descent. He's Brazilian of Angolan descent. So I grew up always loving African animals because of that and feeling really tied to that. I had like a cookie tin with like quarters of like Gabby to Angola fund when I was maybe like 4 years old. So I've always been like really into it. So I can't really say like an exact moment. I think it's a mixture of, you know, my dad and just being into nature documentaries, and maybe I just watched Captain Planet one too many times. but yeah, it's always been something important to me. And I've always been particularly interested in human wildlife conflict ever since I learned that that was a major factor impacting predator habitat destruction, and the fact that it was relatively understudied compared to that. So lifelong passion. It's all I've ever wanted to do. So.
Amazing. Now, the topic we're going to be talking about today, we did say briefly at the beginning, is what I would just describe as a heavy one. And yeah. I don't know if I need to put a disclaimer on the episode. Maybe I do. I don't know. I'm so confused. Okay, let me put a bit of a warning to anyone listening now. We're going to be talking about wildlife poaching.
Right.
So we might be talking about a few things that doesn't sit right with you as if you're conjuring up images. Let me put that. But the topic itself, what we're talking about, is extremely important because to manage poaching, and Gabby, I'm sure you'll agree or correct me here, is that to manage it, we have to understand it fully. And if we don't understand it fully, there's no way of managing it or helping people to manage it. So I guess my first question, we're talking about poaching. Can you start by telling us what poaching is and how it differs from something like sport hunting or hunting?
Yeah, so in very simple terms, poaching is illegal hunting. It's hunting that is not regulated. If we kind of remove all of the connotations, the negative connotations that we have about poaching, that's straight up what it is. Hunting is regulated often by the government, and things are tracked, and there's rules and regulations as to, you know, what kind of animals you can take and how much, and of like, you know, what sex and at what times and all these different things. And mm-hmm. poaching is unregulated hunting it's very broad. I mean, I think, you know, there's bushmeat hunting, which is often very like local subsistence, but also could be, you know, sold in local markets. And then there's things like ivory poaching, which obviously has huge international demand. So it runs the gamut. But yeah, Cliff Notes version, illegal hunting.
Okay. Now, this, I guess we've kind of, it makes sense really, but we're still going to dive into this a bit because, again, we need to understand how, I guess, on what level it's happening and how it affects wildlife. But I guess this changes wherever you go as well, depending on the species and the community. So this is probably a very hard question to answer, but how does it affect wildlife?
So it's hard because it's again, like there's so many different kinds of poaching, but I think like in a macro sense, because it's unregulated, you know, you're removing animals from the population that are really important. For example, if it's not regulated, you could be removing like females from the population that need to help propagate the species, or, you know, like animals who have not reproduced yet. And it's just really difficult, or you're from a social species like elephant, it completely destroys the whole social dynamic of the herd. And so there's a lot of different things. With bushmeat, it also directly relates to human wildlife conflict. So for example, you know, I remember driving through North Central Namibia when I was working down there, and seeing one steenbok, like a tiny little antelope, and anything bigger than that had been shot out because of bushmeat poaching. Because people needed to eat, and meat is expensive, mm-hmm. and they were utilizing what they had, but because there were so many more people in the area that, you know, they shot out anything bigger than a tiny little deer. And because of that, the predators have nothing to eat, and then they eat people's livestock, and then they get shot. Really complicated things. And also, you know, like I was chatting with someone who works in Ghana who deals with like people eating frogs, like endangered frogs. Like there's bushmeat of frogs, and it's really important to the local community in terms of a protein source. But because of that, you know, you have these like extremely endangered frogs that are just, there's very few of them left. And they're working with the community to try to stop people eating these frogs. Yeah, so I think it affects wildlife at all levels in terms of just not even just endangered species, but just like dropping down important populations that then support other species as well.
And I'm glad you brought up that example of frogs there, because I think when I personally think of poaching, I will automatically think of large carnivores or, you know, large land mammals and stuff. But I guess it doesn't matter what the species is. If it's not regulated or legal, I mean, in this country, we're currently doing a mini series on this show about UK bird crime, where our raptors are being illegally killed. So that's poaching. That still happens. And I think it's also, it must help to understand that this is not just something that happens in just Africa or, mm-hmm. you know, just South America. This is a global issue, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think human wildlife conflict and coexistence is a global issue. And often poaching is kind of either helps cause that or is a, you know, consequence of that.
Now, my next question is kind of, we're going to look a bit about the local people. And I guess this is a very broad question because it depends where we're talking about. But how does poaching affect local communities and where it's happening?
So the reasoning, like, I guess I can get in a little bit that can tie in a little bit to like the reasons why people get into poaching. And I can only kind of speak from a mostly African context and within Southern or Eastern Africa. And a lot of the reason why people get into poaching kind of like at a local level is driven by poverty, and not when you necessarily think of like abject poverty. It might not be like they have nothing, although that could be some of it. A lot of the time it's just people like wanting to be able to send their kids to school and having a little bit of upward mobility and trying to make a life for themselves, and you know, in a really challenging environment, and getting involved in poaching that way. And I think poaching obviously affects local communities in terms of the fact that it's illegal. You know, they can be penalized for it, have hefty fines that they have no chance of, you know, or jail time, and can kind of like destroy the fabrics of communities. And a lot of the time people, like local people, get into poaching because there's few other options. And I think that's, again, some of the breakdown in empathy that we sometimes see from the West, where they're just like, oh yeah, just kill all the poachers, right? Like bad people. And it's just like, yeah, but like that's the option that they see available to them. And a lot of the time, you know, the onus is on conservation to help create some of those opportunities. And then the onus is on government to then support conservation and give them resources where they can create other opportunities for people. And some of the best like happy stories I've seen is like ex-poachers working for conservation organizations. They're the best trackers. They know where all the animals are. Like when I was in Kenya working with Big Life Foundation on like one of my first internships, most of the rhino guys were ex-poachers, and they were protecting the rhinos. Like, you know, because they knew where the rhinos were and they knew how to track the rhinos, and they could tell me the difference between like, you know, like a white rhino and a black rhino by like the composition of their dung. Like they were really good. But they had switched into it because they're like, you know, it's so much better than poaching because we have a regular income now that isn't, you know, boom or bust. We don't have to be worried about being arrested. And I do think that most people, like local people, they don't go into poaching because it's fun. Like they go into poaching because that's an option. And as long as there's other options, like most reasonable people would choose other options. It's not a sustainable lifestyle, you know?
But that's a really interesting point there. So when we're looking at the reasons why they go in, like you said, it is because of the restrictive, that there are very few, if not worse off options to go into. And obviously then you've got the conflict as well, where I guess there's a protection element, protecting themselves.
Yeah, that's another aspect, is that what is really important is that, you know, if people do not have benefits from wildlife, you can't expect them to protect wildlife. Why would they? You know, like I always try to think, like, you know, put yourself in a farmer's shoes, and you know, your kid's out herding, and like he runs away because he sees a lion, the lion takes out two of your goats, and it's like, why would you necessarily want to protect that? Even if you intrinsically value that animal, it's a large, dangerous animal that is difficult to live with. And if the government's not supporting you to protect the animal, you're not getting any kind of financial incentive. And then someone says like, look, I'll give you a bunch of money to turn the other way or to help me. Like, and you're just like, well, I need to make my bills. Like it's a logical, like if you remove the emotion from it, it's a logical decision. And I think it's also, I'm very cautious to blame local people for decisions when they're making decisions that make sense to them within the context of their environment. And I really think the way to work on poaching is to try to create systems where people have other options other than poaching. Because I do think that most people would not necessarily choose to be involved.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's very few people out there that would go, oh, this is a career choice. Do you know what I mean? I don't think anyone's thinking that. And that's interesting what you said there about moving or removing the emotion. And this is something I've done myself this year with the conversations I've had around different elements of hunting.
Right.
But I think sometimes it's not only a case of like completely removing the emotion, sometimes it's moving it to a new area to focus on. So saying, I'm not just going to put all my emotion into the lions. I'm going to, you know, take it away for a bit, but I'll go and put my emotion over to the local communities or conservancies in Namibia and, you know, talk to them for a bit and hear about them.
It's all about having empathy. And I think the big thing is, so like as a Black scientist, it always makes me very uncomfortable when people seem to be valuing wildlife more than human lives in the West. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, it's very uncomfortable to me because I'm like, not only is that not sustainable, but you're like, animals are more important than people. And as a conservation biologist, and this might get me some hate, I don't believe that. I don't believe wildlife is more important than human life. I believe that there's a way to protect both. But for that to happen, like you need to have empathy and be able to see where these people are coming from. Because also, like, even just from a selfish reason, if you just want to change people's views, like you don't necessarily feel engaged with the community, but you want to change people's views. if you come up to someone and just kind of like lecture them, you're not going to get the response that you want. And I think it's, you have to be able to have conversations with people on their level. And this is just a human wild left conflict kind of like example. But when I was working in, this was up in the Kavango West, and it was really interesting because this farmer was just like, oh, I hate jackals. I just want to shoot all the jackals. And, you know, I could have just come up to him and been like, you know, like, bro, like, don't do that. That's bad. Jackals are important for the environment. Don't you know that? And, you know, he's mad because they're eating his sheep. So of course that wouldn't have worked. He would have been just like, yeah, whatever. Like, you're a greenie, like, go away. And the way that I got him to really kind of start changing his behavior was I said, you know, if you kill jackals, jackals have more baby jackals. They actually respond to the pressure of being killed and they reproduce faster. So you will actually have more jackals on your land. And there is no way to actually be able to extirpate them unless you got every single person you know and the people they know and the people they know because of their ranges to wipe out all the jackals. And I'm like, who wants to deal with that? Like, it's just easier to manage what you have. And that actually worked. And he was actually didn't have as many like jackal killing incidents after that because he kept going like, oh, wait, I don't want that problem to affect my livelihood. So that's what I mean about connecting people, like where they're at. It's really important.
That bit of information has just blown my mind.
Yeah.
A jackal's like gremlins. What is that?
Yeah, they just have babies. Yeah. It's the other thing with like leopards, where it's just like you want the leopard you know. If you kill a leopard, you're gonna have three leopards fighting for dominance over the territory, and then you're gonna have more problems. So yeah.
What a wonderful way to look at it. I'm trying to pick my words so carefully here, Gabby. I don't know why, because I know how I feel about this, but it's a wonderful way to think, like, you know, it's proven what you're doing, I understand, but also it is creating more of your problem. So let's try and stop that. So you said a minute ago, I want to go back to this as well, because you said you know some people that were poachers or poached before and now work in wildlife conservation from a tracking point of view or work with it. That, I think, is an incredible story. Do you know what I mean? Just to know people. So I guess, have you met poachers as poachers before?
I've actually never met anyone who wasn't an ex-poacher. I'll be honest about that. And the reason behind that is because a lot of the time, like, it's not open. Like, you can't just, like, nobody's, like, in the bar just going, like, I'm a poacher. You know, like, and, like, communities tend to protect their own. So, like, it's hard to sometimes find individuals who are, like, open about poaching. I've met people who did bushmeat poaching before where they're just like, yeah, I go out and I shoot a bunch of antelope and like technically not supposed to, but like, you know, I've had an impala served to me and I'm like, I probably shouldn't be eating this because I'm pretty sure it's from the conservancy. So in that case, yeah, I've never met like an elephant poacher or something like that. And I do think it's just because there's a lot of secrecy. People know that they're doing something that can get them in trouble, which is fair. And I wouldn't want to like accidentally get them in trouble. As much as like I want poachers to be brought to justice, it's complicated because you work with people and you can kind of see what their reasonings are, and I almost would rather them be able to transition into a role within the conservation NGO than get sent to jail. Yeah, it's definitely complicated.
Well, because the punishment for poaching in some areas is, it, how to word this, is life or death, right?
Not where I was. It was like imprisonment and fines that basically there's just no way they can pay it off. But I just don't think that really helps, because if they're poaching because of poverty, like putting them in debt is not gonna make anything better. But yeah, and I think that's why I get quite passionate about, you know, like when I see stuff on Twitter or online about demonizing poachers. It's just kind of like, A, from just a practitioner standpoint, you're not going to get anywhere if you are being aggressive towards people. And B, it's just like, if we can have empathy and kind of see things from other people's point of view, it's easier to be able to address the root causes. And I'm always like the strongest proponent of development work and conservation have to go hand in hand, because no one is going to value wildlife if they're hungry. They're just not. Like, you wouldn't, I wouldn't, like, it's a human thing. Like, there has to be basic needs met before they can even start thinking about something like wildlife conservation. Like, it's a privilege that we were able to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, absolutely spot on. And it's recognizing that and trying to make those changes. And that's something you just mentioned there, which this is actually how we met on Twitter, was this next question. Because I can't remember how many weeks ago, maybe 3-4 weeks.
Yeah, I went on a Twitter rant. I remember that.
Yeah, But I'm so glad you did, because A, I love a rant. So that was lovely to witness. I always like seeing other people go on a rant. But then also what you were talking about was powerful, was really quite, no, I'm not letting this go. I'm not standing by having people, or let people have this opinion. And from your work point of view, that's, I see that as quite a noble and brave thing to do, because it's not an opinion necessarily that everyone's going to go, yeah, of course I stand with you on that. Even people that work within the industry. So to get the listeners up to speed, there was recently a conversation on Twitter about, in essence, people wanting to kill poachers as a repercussion. So can you give us your kind of reaction when you see that?
Tired? Tired is my reaction, as in many things with conservation. I not necessarily anger, but I think it's because I have personal relationships with people who are ex-poachers that I've seen do amazing conservation work. And again, just the idea of kind of like devaluing humans from a very comfortable standpoint. And my big challenge is, you know, like I get the same thing of like, you know, somebody shoots a lion, they're just like, they should kill the guy for shooting that lion. And I'm just like, you don't understand the pressures these people are under. I don't understand it, and I've lived there and worked with them intensively, and I can never understand it in the same way. And I think it's the whole idea of like, conservation doesn't work once we start devaluing human lives. And there are arguments of like, oh, but there's tons of people and these animals are endangered, but like, they're human lives. Like, we can't treat them differently. And there is a racial and socioeconomic component that makes me, again, very uncomfortable with the idea that you wouldn't be saying like, if a guy in England shot a hawk, that you should like string him up. You wouldn't say that because it's different, but there's so much devaluing of people from the global South. And, you know, like I said, my dad is Brazilian of Angolan descent from the global South. And this is just something I feel really passionate about. And I think it's easy to be angry. It's easy to kind of rage out and be like, yeah, these guys should die for doing what they did. It's a lot harder to be able to take a step backwards and see things from a more nuanced perspective. And that's not why I'm saying like we should let people kill all the elephants in the world or whatever. But I think like to be able to solve a problem, you need to like understand what that problem is. And if you're looking at it as these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, you're not understanding the problem, and that problem will never be solved. So my reaction was kind of like seeing a very black and white discourse and doing what I usually do, which is like jump in there and kind of like make it a bit more gray and be like, look, like it's way more complicated than like we understand. I don't necessarily think of it as brave or anything, because like if people disagree with me, like they're welcome to do so. But I do think it's important to, if I've had experiences that are helpful potentially to people, to voice those opinions. And if I get flamed, so be it. I mean, like, you know, like I think it's more important for me to be able to be of help than any kind of potential blowback I would get.
I think, yeah, as soon as you were using the phrase, which is an important phrase, of like devaluing human life, I think when you use a phrase like that, I think I can't imagine anyone, and I'm sure there will always be people that don't read that and listen to it, but I don't know many people that could read that and go, oh, wait a minute, what? Like, you know, and instantly start to change the way they think, because you're right. You're kind of saying, you know, I've got no connection to this area. I've never been there a lot of the time, yet this is what I think the repercussion should be. And you're like, whoa, like put your mindset, like lay it out on the ground a minute, because you're saying the punishment for killing should be killing. So who puts, it's like the death penalty. It's like, you just can't go there. Like, yeah, it's so extreme. And I'm so glad that there were people talking about it, because I'd never actually seen it said on Twitter before. So for me, it was like a double shock. One, I'd found out people were suggesting that, but then it was nice to see people going, no, you can't be doing that.
Well, not even suggesting it, like people make jokes. Like there was some Mozambican who were crossing over from Kruger who had been poachers, and they got attacked by lions. People were like, oh, they got where it was coming from, like, and like making jokes. And I'm just like, that's a tragedy. Like, it's sad. Like, they're not doing this for fun. And again, it's, I don't think people like are thinking of them, because people like to think that they're good people, right? Like, everyone likes to think that they're the good guys. So I don't think they're thinking of it in terms of like, I'm being a bad person, I'm devaluing human life. But I think it's being out of touch. And sometimes all it takes is kind of to shine the mirror of like, this is the behavior. Is this what you mean? And if it's not what you mean, don't say it, because it matters, you know? And I was talking to my friend, like some of my ex-poster friends, where I'm like, do you know that people wish that you had been shot? Because they do. They do. There are people out there who have never met you who would have preferred that you'd been shot.
And what was their reaction to that?
Shock and sadness. And they're just like, I can't believe, like, these people don't know me. These people don't know what I've been through or why I did what I did. And, like, they actually believe that about me. And it was really hard to see and really hard to experience, but I had to let them know. I'm like, look, like, this is what people think. And I'm so glad you're here, and I'm so glad that you're doing the work that you do. But not everyone values that. Yeah.
Well, Gabby, that's heavy and deep. That is like, that's amazing. And well done for you for spreading that, even though it's hard to do it. But what, I guess, I'm not to try and sum up, because this is such a complex, we could have this conversation all day about this topic, but what do you think is the best route in lowering poaching?
I would say, and this is extremely complex, I would say the major problem is that a lot of people take a very top-down approach in terms of like, we need to put poachers in jail or slap fines on them, and like a very like law enforcement approach. And while that could reduce poaching in the short term because everyone's in prison, I don't think it's very sustainable, because the drivers behind why people turn to poaching are still there. So I think, and this isn't like kind of like a sexy solution, like many things in conservation, it takes a lot of time and a lot of work and decades, and maybe that's decades more than these animals have, which is why it is important to have that law enforcement for the short term. I'm not saying get rid of law enforcement. I think that's a great short-term solution, but I think in additional to that, like, we need to work on things like valuing conservation enough within countries to give organizations and governments the resources to be able to do things like campaigns within the communities. For example, bushmeat hunting, like the organization I'm thinking of is called Herp Ghana, that works with the frogs. And they've been very successful just going to the community and talking to people. And they do something called like evangelical conservation, where they go into churches and stuff, and they like bring that into sermons and things like that. And getting kids to really care about the wildlife and then spread that to their parents. And just kind of like a very slow generational shift that works. And I think things like that, but also on top of that, I think there needs to be a lot more of a nexus between conservation and like development organizations. But I think the major problem with conservation in general, like, it's awesome that a few people can be hired in conservation who are ex-poachers, and now they're, you know, working in a conservation organization. But just like everything in conservation, it's so underfunded that there's such a limitation as to what can be done. So I think it's almost like it's got to be a mind shift in terms of, we have to care about sustainability of the planet. And I think that a lot of things we're being so reactive to problems rather than proactive, which I understand, especially if countries have other things that they're dealing with, but it'd be nice to see more support and more connection between, like, I was asked the other day about like, if I could solve a conservation problem, like what problem would I solve? And I said, poverty. And they're just like, I thought you were gonna say like save the lions. I'm like, no, like I will never solve poverty. But I mean, like, you know, come closer it. But I think like that's a conservation problem. That is the conservation problem. And once that gets addressed in any way, even at a small scale, then people have the space to do things like learn and do things like care and change their behavior. But if they're under all these pressures, like, we cannot reasonably expect people to care about wildlife. We can't. They're hungry, or they're trying to move up in the world, or they have so many different things that we can't even like understand pressuring them in certain directions.
That's a really good, I love that line as well. I'm so glad you gave that as your answer. I think I'm gonna quote you on that when I do the write-up of the show. I think it's great.
Cool.
My last question is the question everyone gets, and it's a hard one, but if you could just pass on one bit of advice onto everyone on the planet regarding the natural world, what would it be?
Wow, that's like the biggest question of all time. regarding the natural world, I think my advice would be, remember humanity is part of the natural world. It's not to forget that. So my advice would be, remember that we're part of a holistic ecosystem and that human rights are inextricably related to animal rights. We cannot prioritize one over the other if we want conservation to be sustainable.
Gabby, this has been an absolute... See, we kept it light. That was a light conversation.
Wasn't too bad.
It's all right, wasn't it?
It was like 40% essential despair, 60% fun. You did okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Strangely, in an episode about poaching, I smiled a lot when I was talking and listening. Yeah. So, Gabby, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much for sharing your insight into this. You know, let's call a spade, it's a difficult topic. It is, regardless of where we are in the world. So thank you so much for passing your insight. It's been an absolute pleasure. For now, as we're talking, Merry Christmas. Have a great one. For next year, for people that are listening, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And I'll keep in touch, and I'm sure I'll pass all across again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Gabby is working on, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at FloreGS. And as always, don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.